Five Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Good morning, Portland. Welcome to another wonderful Saturday morning. My name is Chuck Price. I'm a President Wealth Manager with the Price Financial Group Wealth Management, and welcome you to another wonderful Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon. And I got in studio with me Kevin Stege with the Baker Coastal CPA firm.
Hello, Chuck.
Morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
And Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen. And I welcome your enthusiasm.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to have a wealth of ideas today for our listeners. And listen, if you want to have an opportunity to join in the fun and the excitement, give us a call at 503-417-7626, 503-417-7626. We're going to discuss estate planning, we're going to discuss taxes, and we're going to discuss a little bit about investing. So if you've got a call, if you've got a question, give us a call. We have a line open right now, so give us a call. You can get right in and ask your question at 503-417-7626. Well, guys, I've had a really busy week myself. I had numerous people coming in from our radio show, which is always great to actually get to meet people who listen to our show. And fortunately, some of them were able to help and some of them were not able to help. And one of the things that I feel I have a real difference in the practice that I operate in, and one of the things I'm going to talk about in my book is that one of the things in my industry, and we kind of talked a little bit about this, Carl, you and I have several times, is that if somebody comes into me and they have a really good portfolio, I'm not going to tell them that they don't. I'm going to tell them the truth. I'm going to tell them they got a good portfolio and there's nothing wrong. You know, and I always tell clients, I have no problem in getting a second opinion. If somebody tells you to change something, though, they should put it in writing. They should be willing to put it in writing, have you go back to your own advisor and discuss it with them. I mean, there shouldn't be any problem in doing that. You have a right to do that because you paid that advisor fees or commissions or whatever, and you have a right to ask them about the investment portfolio. But I try to be very honest and upfront with people when they bring in their portfolio, and I tell them if I can help them or not. And I also tell them if their portfolio is sound and good, I tell them that. And unfortunately, in my industry, that's not the norm. I hate to say it, but it's not the norm. And I think that's one thing I want people to know out there, that we will look at your portfolio. We'll give you an honest assessment. We're not just going to try to sell you something because, you know, we don't need business that bad to have to tell somebody that their portfolio isn't good when it is good.
You know, I think that's true. I think for a lot of professionals is that, there are some people who, look at how much money they can make doing whatever they're doing, and others who really look for the best interest of the client. And, you know, I certainly feel the same way you do, Chuck, that if someone comes into my office and says, I want a super duper trust, and it turns out that their estate just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make economic sense or it doesn't make legal sense. I'm going to tell them I don't think that's a great idea, and you're going to, just kind of waste your money. And if they still want to do it, I guess we can do that. But they're going to get the straight scoop. At least is what I think about it. And I suppose that reasonable people can differ sometimes. But and everybody has a kind of a different philosophy too. So, but I think it's really important that you have that openness with your client to be able to tell them. You know, they told us in law school that a good lawyer tells a client what he needs to know, not what he wants to hear. And that's what we try to do.
I think that should be said for financial planners as well. It really should be, because I think that's the most important thing. You got to be honest and direct with people. And if I see somebody that's done a really good job, I compliment the guy. I compliment the other advisor, whether it be a man or a woman. But I compliment and say, hey, your advisor's done a really good job for you. And I think that I'm not going to say I do that 100% of the time, because 100% of the time it doesn't work out that way. But I do when I see it. And if I see it, I absolutely tell people.
And I think with accountants, you have to be careful of somebody who's going to tell you too much what you want to hear. Are they giving you too much of a refund? Are they, especially if their fee is based on the amount of refund that they get back for you, that should send up a warning signal right away.
Well, I can't speak for every CPA, but I can tell you in my working experience with CPAs, there are good and there are bad. And Kevin's a good one. And I've had both, unfortunately. And, I guess you get what you pay for, and sometimes you don't. You get something worse when you pay for it. But I think everybody is entitled to a second opinion on whatever they're doing. And they're entitled to total honesty by whoever they're working with. And if you're not getting that, then you need to change. You know, you really should get it. And sometimes people don't want to hear what you tell them. I talked to a person the other day, and they have no will. They have no trust. They have nothing. They're in their 80s. And, I said, listen, you're not going to live forever. You got to get an estate plan put together. You've got some assets. You want them to go to your children. And I got news for you. The way everything's set up right now, it's all going in your estate. That's not the way to do it. And, a lot of people think, I'm going to spend the last dollar I'm on earth. The last day I'm on earth, I'm spending my last dollar. But Carl, you and I know that doesn't work that way.
No, and it's very important to make those kind of plans, even if they're relatively simple, even if your estate is modest. In fact, when you think about it, the more modest estate may be more important to your loved ones than the person who has, a lot of wealth, because they're going to be okay no matter what. But you don't want to have a bunch of the estate sort of squandered and leaving very little for your heirs if you're trying to, preserve something for them.
Well, I was talking to a gentleman the other day that called me, actually from the radio show, and we were talking about his situation. And he has all very successful children, and he has a substantial estate way over the state estate tax limit by about $3 million. And so, when we were talking, I said, I understand you don't care about leaving money to whoever, but the reality is, if you don't do something, the state of Oregon's going to get about $600,000 of that $3 million, and your kids and grandkids aren't. So I said, I don't know about you, but if it comes to my kids and my grandkids versus the state of Oregon or the state of Washington, I'll tell you what, the grandkids and the kids beat the state every time.
That's a lot of years of working to just hand over when you could, with some planning, pass that on to other people other than just the state.
Yeah, and I think one of the misconceptions, Carl, a lot of people think that to do a good estate plan is going to cost them tens of $20,000. And the reality is it isn't that expensive. It's way more expensive to not do it.
Well, that's certainly true, and it depends. Certainly they range depending on how complex it is. The more complex it is, the more expensive it is. But it's not typically. It pales in comparison to not doing anything.
Okay, we've got a caller on the line. Nancy has a concern about a comment that Chuck made last week about spying on neighbors. I don't remember that, but Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you for taking my call. I do enjoy your show.
Well, thank you.
It's spying on neighbors, that's my word. You had been talking about people that are receiving workman's comp or Social Security disability, and one of you had said that maybe take a camera, and if you see somebody, a neighbor that is on disability and you know they shouldn't be, take a camera and photograph them. And I just thought that that was so very much like Nazi Germany, where you spy on your neighbors, and something has to be done about the system, but spying on neighbors, that's not a very good call.
Well, Nancy, I'm going to have to go back and replay our show, because I don't remember that comment. I think the only thing I remember us talking about is that the system is full of people beating the system, and there's got to be a way to stop people from cheating the system, because we're all paying dearly for it. That's why our country's, you know, $17 trillion in debt. But I don't remember anybody saying about going and taking a picture of anybody, and I don't remember. I'll go back and listen to the show again, but I don't remember that. Do you, either of you, remember any of that? I don't remember that at all.
I don't recall that.
I don't think that was our show. I think that might have been one of the other shows on this network, but it wasn't ours. I don't think we discussed turning people in or taking, you know, people to task on that. But I don't know. I don't, you know, I'll go back and listen to it. And if it is, I'll say so on the air, but I don't think so. I don't think that was our show, Nancy, but I happen to agree with you. I don't want to be Nazi Germany either. It's close enough to that now. I don't want to get any closer.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for taking my call, and I will continue to listen to your show.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy. That was a nice call. Thank you. I don't remember, guys. Do you remember anything about taking a picture?
I'm not sure I remember breakfast. So,
Well, you know, that's the problem. But the good thing is I got it taped, and I'll go back and listen to it. And I don't remember that part of the conversation at all. But there's a lot of shows on this network, and there's a lot of shows I hear on radio about that very such thing. And I'm not sure I like having Big Brother seeing everything we do either. I'm not too excited about that, but I do know you have to have controls.
You know, there was a story on the radio that I was listening to on the way in today about how upset the German chancellor is, and the German people are about, you know, finding out that the NSA is tapping into her phone calls, and not just hers, but and I think. You know, I can't say that I blame him. That strikes me as a pretty far stretch.
Well, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting. I heard I can't remember who the guy was, but he is with either worked for the government or does work for the government. And his comment was, everybody does it. And I thought, that's not a good excuse.
Well, that's like, remember when you tried that excuse with your parents, you know, well, everybody's doing it. And they say, well, you know, if everybody's jumping off a bridge, are you going to do that too?
Well, that's right.
It may not be
that's
a good
right.
thing, you know.
No, I don't know how long this activity has been going on, but I don't think it's a way to build goodwill within other countries at all. And hopefully our country shapes up and quits doing it.
Well, some of the things that have made our country so good is, you know, we allow personal responsibility, personal gain, loss, privacy, and I just don't think that some people realize that when government becomes so big that you lose a lot of that, and it undermines what has made us such a great country, along with goodness. Also, we have been a moral and good country, and I liked, of all things, this happens to be a French historian, but Alexis de Tocqueville said back in the 1800s when he was looking at the United States and trying to determine what made the U.S. rise so quickly, and he said, America's great because she is good. When she ceases to be good, she'll cease to be great, and I just hope we're not going away from being good.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think one thing about Americans that we probably help, well, I know we give more to charity and helpful causes all over the world than any other country. And we represent, what, 5% of the world's population? And so we continue to be the leader in bailing other places out and helping other places when a catastrophe happens. So I think that goodness of America is there. I think the one thing that has kind of lost a little bit of luster in our country is the accountability of people being accountable of politicians now with YouTube. If you go on YouTube, you can paint about any politician as a liar and be able to call them a liar and be able to actually authenticate it with their own words right off of YouTube, because they tend to forget what they say. And
kind of like us from last week.
Kind of like us from last week. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I hope not. But impossible. And the thing is, if it's taped and it's recorded in the society we're living in today, it's you get caught. You know, you really do. So it's just the way it is. Well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl's comments on another wonderful Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon. We are live. We are here to take your calls. 503-417-7626. 503-417-7626 on Investing Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This morning on Carl's comments, I just want to briefly touch on a kind of a sensitive subject. One of the things I deal with a lot of elderly people, and one of the things that often happens is that they have relatives that will move in as sort of informal caretakers, shall we say, caregivers. And sometimes that works really well, and sometimes it works very badly. And usually that has to do with the reasons why the relatives move back in. If they're moving back in because they really love their parent or whoever, and they really feel a duty to them, and that's why they're doing it, that's a great reason. On the other hand, if they're moving in because they, you know, it's more convenient for them than, you know, working two jobs and, you know, living in a low-income housing or something, then that's probably not as good an idea. But in any event, sometimes when it turns bad, it spills over into what we call abuse. And it's a very common problem in our society today. And one of the things that happens is that sometimes you'll have someone who you've brought into your home that becomes abusive. And so I just wanted to discuss two of the laws that are available for to help a person. But I see that we have a question. Jeff, are you online?
I sure am. Good morning, fellas.
Hi, Jeff. Good morning, Jeff.
Morning.
What is your question about a disability trust, is what my note says.
Yeah, I have a son that's 10 years old. He has autism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to you guys this morning on estate planning, and my wife and I were kind of in our income-earning years,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to get started with that, but I wasn't sure if a disability trust is a standalone type of thing versus the estate planning, or are they all combined together? So when you sit down, you do it all at one time, or are they two separate kind of things?
Well, it certainly could be done as a standalone trust. It could also be done as part of your estate planning. What we often call that is a supplemental needs trust or a special needs trust. And the idea behind it generally is to design the trust in such a way that distributions from the trust don't disqualify the beneficiary, in this case your son, from any kind of governmental benefits that he or she might receive. And there are certain governmental benefits which if you have assets or if you have too much income, will be disqualified. And that's probably not a good thing. So a lot of times what happens is that we design it into the estate plan so that if you and your spouse were to pass away, that the successor trustee, the person who would manage your estate, you would designate so much money or some portion or the whole thing to this supplemental needs trust, and the trustee would then administer it in such a way so that if son qualified for governmental benefits, that the distributions that were made that would augment those things, that would supplement those things, would be made without jeopardizing the existing governmental benefits. So it's kind of, since he's young like that, I mean, the likelihood is that the supplemental needs trust probably won't come into play until quite some time later. So it probably would be, I would probably recommend doing it as part of your estate plan.
Okay, excellent. That's what I needed to know.
Okay.
Thank you, fellas. Have a great day.
Thanks. Very good question.
Yeah, it was fascinating. So it does happen. We do them, and then they're a useful tool for.
And a lot of times it may just be you don't want to give a large sum of money to somebody who can't financially manage their own affairs.
Sure.
And so you just want to designate, hey, we're going to tie this down so that somebody allocates it for their actual benefit.
Right. In that setting, we tend to call that a spendthrift trust, which, you know, sort of protect them from themselves, and it has probably a great deal more flexibility than the disability trust, because the federal government has certain rules about the disability type trust, but the spendthrift trust you can do mostly whatever you want.
Yeah, I'm going to assume that what he's really kind of looking at is probably a special needs trust.
It sounds like a special needs trust.
I've got some clients that have special needs trusts for their children, and it's really an important thing, because it allows them to have the assets, but yet it allows them to not lose anything that they're entitled to.
Right.
And that's kind of a nice thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little tricky, but it's not that tough once you figure out what the situation is of the particular person that's going to be the beneficiary. But back to what we were talking about just briefly, there are, I wanted to talk about two chapters in the Oregon law that give a remedy for the situation where it's almost an emergency and you need an elder person or a disabled person or maybe just a family person has this person that's moved into their home and they need to get them out and they need to get some relief. And so the first one, if it's an elder person, is the Elder Abuse Act, and that's under ORS Chapter 124. And under that, a person who is 65 or older is an elderly person, so they automatically qualify. The chapter also applies to someone who is a person with a disability, which means a person who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activity. So, and that doesn't necessarily mean someone who's, you know, in a wheelchair or something. It can mean a lot of different things. So either 65 or with disability, and abuse is a fairly broad term too. Abuse means physical injury, means neglect, means willful infliction of pain or injury. It actually also means use of derogatory or inappropriate names, phrases, or profanity, ridicule, harassment, coercion, threats, etc. So such that it would cause emotional damage to the elderly person or disabled person. And finally, that's the kind of what we call that's what we typically think of as abuse. And then the flip side of that is financial abuse, which also comes into play. And that's just merely wrongfully appropriating or taking money from an elderly person or a disabled person. So those are the kinds of things. And what the statute allows is for the aggrieved person to go in and get what amounts to a restraining order from the court. and gets the person who's doing the abuse removed from the home, restrains them from further contact if that's necessary, can get a restraint that keeps them from doing any further prohibited conduct, and they can get also under certain circumstances damages and attorney's fees for committing the abuse and try to get sort of restitution. Oftentimes that doesn't always work. So, but that's one section of it. That's dealing with elders. The other part is called the Family Abuse Prevention Act. And it's most often seen in domestic situations where, you know, the one spouse beats up on the other spouse kind of thing. But it applies to many more people than that. So for example, the people that it applied to include a person who's your husband, wife, or domestic partner, former husband, or wife, or domestic partner, an adult with whom you are living or did live in a sexual relationship, an adult with whom you have been in a sexual relationship in the past 2 years. And here's one that most people don't think of all the time, is an adult related to you by blood, marriage, or adoption, the parent of your child. So in other words, if you have a child who's moved in or is related to you by blood, and it turns out that they're a bad bet for you to have in your house, they become abusive, well, then they are can fall under this chapter. And that would be even if you're not necessarily 65. So the abuse has to take place within 180 days of the time that you seek a remedy from the court. And the abuse has to be either that there's physically injured, they tried to physically injure you, they made you afraid that he or she was about to physically injure you, or they made you have sexual relations against your wishes by using force or threats of force. So that's the kind of abuse we're talking about. If that's the case, then you can go to any circuit court where you live, and you can. They have forms. In fact, I even have them here for one of the counties, where you can go in, file a petition, and we have what's called an ex parte hearing. In other words, you get to go before the judge by yourself, and if your petition says shows by a preponderance of the evidence that one of those elements has been reached. In other words, that usually it's that he's made you afraid of being physically injured, then you get a restraining order and give it to the sheriff. The sheriff runs out to the home and takes the person who's doing it and kicks them out. They then get a notice of that, and they have an opportunity to object, and they can have a hearing to determine whether or not they actually did what you say they did. But generally people don't, well, that's not entirely true, but a lot of times people do not, you know, they're not lying about it, but, you know, some people do for wrongful reasons. Sometimes in the context of a domestic situation, it's used as kind of a tool to get some advantage with respect to child custody or, you know, that kind of thing. But in the context of what we're talking about more in terms of an elder kind of situation or a parent-child situation of adults, they're usually not lying if they go to the trouble of going to do that. So there are remedies out there, and you can find those forms and everything. You can get them at any circuit court. So if you're in Portland, you'd go to Multnomah County Circuit Court. If you're in Washington County, you'd go to Hillsborough, to the Washington County Court in Clackamas County and like. And there's no fee for filing a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order. So that's kind of how it works. It's unfortunate, but it does come up, and it's one of those things that I think people should be aware of.
Carl, according to the law, at what age is somebody considered an elder to be under elder abuse?
Oh, 65.
It is age 65.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you're over 65, mm-hmm. but if you're 62,
then you would have to fall under the Family Abuse Prevention Act.
But what if it's not a family member?
Well, it would be one of these other people, you know, somebody that was living there. But if they're not, then you have a bigger problem. If it's somebody that's really like a stranger, you know, then it becomes more difficult, especially if you have brought this person into your home in a way that makes them look like a tenant or, you know, something like that, because then you may have to comply with the landlord-tenant law, which is a whole lot of stuff, lots of notice requirements. It becomes very awkward. Or worse yet, there's another procedure that if they're not a tenant, that means they're something else. And if they're something else, then a lot of times you have to go through what's called an ejectment proceeding, which is just like a standard lawsuit and could take, you know, a long time to get them out of your house. So I guess the caveat there is if you're going to bring people in to live in your home with you, make sure you know who they are and how you're going to get along with them before you let them do that, because it can be a bad deal and expensive and you know, a real awkward situation.
Well, you know, I was aware of a particular situation where an elderly lady and just barely over 65, I'm assuming, had her daughter and the daughter's husband move in with them, and unbeknownst to her, they had gotten in with the wrong people, and they had a lot of threats and pressure, financial pressure on them, and so the children talked the mother into refinancing the home, taking all the equity out of the home, and trying to make the children's situation better. Well, it didn't end up that way. It never does.
That's what we call financial elder abuse.
Exactly right.
That's it for sure.
And the FBI got involved in this one. So it was pretty...
Was there drugs involved, probably?
I don't know the underlying pressures.
Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come back with the tax investigator. And you're listening to Investing Simplified. You can reach us at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We'll be right back with the tax investigator.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You're listening to Investing Simplified here, broadcasting out of downtown Portland. And Carl, that's deep topic, tough things to talk about, but that's the reality of some of the things that maybe not all of us have to deal with, but it certainly happens, and maybe even to a lesser extent, maybe not the so much the physical abuse, but you know, even just when somebody starts getting elderly and they're living on their own, you know, do good neighbors start befriending them? And, you know, certain family heirlooms, certain things of value start disappearing from the home, not from them taking it, but simply because the elderly person is, you know, giving them away and you know, think that's a good thing. But definitely some things to look out for. Well, tongue in... Oh, go ahead.
No. I'm just agreeing with you there.
Yes. Well, tongue in cheek, we've got more elder abuse going on, this time by the state of Oregon. Not quite, though. for 2014, coming up, maybe you are over the age of 62 and you've benefited from the Oregon Special Medical Deduction. Well, you may not benefit so much from that anymore. In fact, you won't benefit from it. It used to be that when one of the two spouses was over the age of 62, Oregon allowed all of your medical deductions for the whole family. Now they are cracking down on that. They figured that benefited upper income earners too much, and people that, you know, spend a lot of money on medical deductions, I guess. And so now only the spouse that is over 62, only their medical deductions are able to be deducted on Oregon. And then there's also, this is probably the worst part, there's an $1,800 cap on it. So it's not an unlimited special Oregon medical deduction anymore. So this is definitely kind of puts a little damper on keeping track of all of your medical receipts when you know you're not going to benefit on the federal level, but you used to always benefit on the Oregon level. Now, save up to $1,800 per person if they're over 62 and move on with life, I guess.
What if somebody has terminal cancer and they have unbelievable expenses and costs and they're only 42 years old?
Well, you still get the amount that's over 10% of your AGI. I mean, that's the standard federal limitation on medical deductions.
Okay, so you still get that.
Yeah, yeah. And so if that flows through on your federal, it'll also flow through on Oregon. You just don't get the extra medical deduction that Oregon had allowed. So something to note in the future. Changing topics, we are starting into our year-end tax planning and some things to consider. Today we're going to talk about capital gains and whether or not you should recognize capital gains for this year or whether you should not recognize them by the end of the year. And maybe it's not just the end of the year. Maybe it's for your whole estate plan. Probably one of the key things to look at regarding capital gains is, number one, do you really need the cash from selling this asset? Capital gains, we're talking typically stocks, securities, or your real estate. You know, if it's your home, we've got other rules that apply. So we're really talking about investments, such as you would have safely tucked away with Chuck. And whether...
Smart move.
That's right. And whether you should sell those or not. So really one of the first things to consider is your tax bracket. And if you are in the 10 or 15% tax bracket, capital gains are probably not going to get any lower than they are now for the next year or so, maybe 2 years. There's a lot of talk, a lot of stirrings that they're going to be increasing the maximum capital gain limits in the future. As a way to help pay for, I was trying to go a whole show without saying this, but Obamacare and other government expenditures. So definitely look at your tax bracket. If you're married filing joint and you have gross income of $92,000 or less, you're going to be subject to 0% capital gain rate, which is very nice. Now, Oregon obviously has their 9%. But if you're across the river listening to us in Washington and you're well under that $92,000, it may be you could sell that security, get those capital gains off the table, recognize it in income. You could even turn around and buy it the next day if you wanted and get right back into the same position and just wipe those capital gains right off.
That's right, because the wash sale only applies to losses.
That's exactly right.
A lot of people get confused about that.
That's right. One thing to consider when doing that, though, is say you recognize $50,000 in income and maybe your only other income was Social Security, you are going to make more of your Social Security taxable by having a higher AGI. You're going to be raising your AGI so that calculations based on the adjusted gross income threshold are going to get worse for you, such as the medical deduction. So you do want to kind of look at some of those items to see if you're going to maybe make some more of your other income taxable. But if you're not receiving Social Security and you don't have large medical expenses, it may be good to take some capital gains off the table. Another way to, obviously another thing to consider is your holding period. Almost always make sure you hold something, over a year. Now, if it's an investment that you just need to get out of, don't let the tax tail wag the dog. But just by holding it a year, you could significantly drop your, even in the 10% bracket, from being taxed at ordinary rates in the 10% bracket, if you just hold it, you know, a few more months and you're making 10%, that's pretty good. So,
yeah, anytime you can push it into capital gains instead of ordinary income, you're usually better off.
That's right. So hold it for a year and a day if you can. Another way to potentially avoid capital gains is gifting appreciated stock directly to charity. If you're at a place where, I know I'm going to make a charitable a contribution, you can, and you've got some, you've got a particular security that instead of you selling it and having to recognize the capital gains on it and then giving the net cash to charity, if you go ahead and donate that directly to the charity, you get the deduction at the fair market value, and then you don't have to pay the capital gains, and actually the charity ends up with more money also.
Yeah, it's a tax-free gift for them.
Exactly. So, yeah. And it's very simple to do. Publicly traded securities are very easy to report on your tax return. All you need is the date of contribution, what your basis is, when you bought it, how many shares, and a description of it, and you can just put it on your Form 8283 and move forward.
But an important thing here, Kevin, and you kind of alluded to it, but I just kind of want to make sure everybody understands out there, if you decide that you bought 100 shares of Microsoft a long, long time ago when they started, and now that's worth $1.5 million, and your cost basis is $40,000, and you give that to your child, that cost basis goes forward, and they have that total capital gain, but they got to hold it a year, because once they take ownership of it, they got to hold it to get the long-term capital gains. And a lot of people get screwed up in that. They think they can give a stock to a kid, they can sell it, and the kid's going to pay capital gains. Not necessarily true.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that when you make it a lifetime gift, you're giving them your basis. So if you have a $40,000 basis and it's $1 million stock, you're going to have whatever that is, $960,000
forever,
on the gain. And yep. So if you want to do that, I mean, one other way to do that is to wait until you die, and then they can get a stepped-up basis in delivering the stock
to
them.
That's so. Exactly right. That's what we recommend if you're going to give it to a person. If you're going to give it to charity, and this year we've had an amazing amount of people because this is the last year that you can give your IRA distribution directly to a charity. But a lot of the companies that we work with are not allowing the people to send the money directly to the charity. They'll make the check out to the charity, but they send the check to the client's house. Same results tax-wise, but it's just not as clean as it was before. And I think that's because they're all getting set up to change this law.
I think so. And you guys alluded to my next point, and that is if you gifting to an adult child or to a parent so that they can, you know, maybe it's not a huge amount of stock. Maybe it's only $10,000. You could gift that stock to an adult child or a parent who may be in a very low bracket. They could go ahead and sell it, recognize the $10,000 of capital gain, and now it's the money's still in the family. But notice I said an adult child. It can't be your child under the age of 17, or the kiddie tax rules apply, and that income is basically brought back into your tax return if you have a young child with unearned income over, I believe it's $3,200 or somewhere around there, $1,700. I don't have it in front of me.
It's not much.
Yeah, and so it can hurt fairly quick. Well, here's another interesting thing to look at, and this is out of my area of expertise and definitely smack dab in your area, Chuck, but just your portfolio allocations can make a big difference in your capital gains, such as investing in things like oil and gas or real estate investment trusts that create a current ordinary loss for you. I don't know if it's ordinary, but they create a current deductible loss. That's what I meant to say for you. But the security and the investment itself could grow in value down the road. And so if you have maybe a portion of your portfolio in something that's creating a bit of a loss for you that can go against some of your other capital gains, maybe not a bad strategy. And that's definitely
Yeah, some of your real estate investment trusts will pay, if you're investing money in it, they'll pay, 7% plus. And what they do is part of that income you're getting is actually called return of principal. And so you may get a 7% dividend, but you're only paying tax on 3%. And so 4% is really a return of principal. The problem is you need to make sure you keep track of that. And the idea is to turn that into capital gain instead of ordinary income. And it makes a lot of sense. And so a lot of them are set up that way.
Exactly. Exactly. And obviously the conventional wisdom, if you have something where you need to sell it to get your cash to use it for a particular purpose, is to just try to offset it with other losses that you may have, maybe holding on through 2008. That's, pretty standard. Hopefully, it's nice to not have that option available and have all gains in there, but that's not always the case.
No, it looks like to me that for 214, I don't know, have the regulations came out yet for sure what the capital gains rate's going to be?
That's funny you mentioned that. I spent some good time last night trying to lock it down and just get something out of the IRS.gov or other authoritative material. And it appears that basically the rates that we have in place for 2013 are permanent. So the 0% will go on if you're in the 10 to 15% bracket. The capital gains will get taxed at zero. If you're over 400,000, you're going to have a 20% plus the 3.8% Medicare surcharge on net investment income. So those are permanent, but it's a good chance that those are going to get altered down the road to make sure that folks with lots of extra cash can help finance our current situation.
Yeah, I think you're right, Kevin. Yep, I think you're right. Yeah, yeah, I tried to go online, too, to find out if there was a tax rates for next year, and I couldn't find anything that said it's definite, but yep. I assumed it's going to continue on.
It is. They have been made permanent. So.
Now, they did come out. They did come out the other day, which kind of made me mad. They're giving a raise to Social Security to keep all those votes coming in because of,
cost
money,
of living.
Money buys, yeah. But for the working guy, they didn't increase the limits for your IRA deduction or your 401k. Now, I mean, how stupid is that? That, we need to have people saving money, putting money aside, and yet the government keeps restricting what you can put aside. It's insane.
Yeah, once they run their calculations, they round it up or down to the nearest 100 or 500 or 1,000, and so it stayed the same for them.
Just imagine if these people, the same people that are doing this, are the ones that tell you shouldn't eat at McDonald's, but yet they make you line up and eat Big Macs all day and then get mad at you because you're overweight. I mean, that's the same thing as they're doing to the tax code. They're saying, hey, you got to save money for the future because Social Security is going to get reduced in 2033, but we're going to restrict how much you can put in to bury for your retirement.
Yeah.
It's insane.
And as we've mentioned before, the median wage for the average worker has, from 2000 to 2013, has gone down 7% over that period. So that's the reality of where we're at. So give us a call, 503-417-7626. We've got a line open and we've got a little bit of time. Call in soon if you've got a question on capital gains or
estate planning or investing. We're going to take a quick break and come back with the Knowledge Trust and try to get your calls answered if you give us a call, 503-417-7626. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had a
Well, if you have $1 million, give us a call real quick, and we'll talk to you about investing that $1 million and also planning your estate. And Kevin will make sure you keep your taxes low. So there's our three guarantee for if you have $1 million. Well, listen, this is a time we kind of get together and talk about the Knowledge Trust and we discuss things. But Kevin, you were saying on the break there that you had another point that you didn't get a chance to.
Oh,
get in. So
exactly on saving capital gains. If you are considering retiring to a sunny state or maybe across the river, maybe wait to sell and recognize those capital gains if you're moving to Washington, Florida, Nevada, or another state that does not have income tax. You'll be able to save the state income tax rate on your capital gains. So in Oregon, that would be 9% if you were retiring across the river to Washington. That's not, especially if it's a significant capital gain, that's not an insignificant amount to save.
Yeah, 9% is 9%.
That's right.
You know, every $100,000, that's $9,000. Boy, I'm really good with the math there. But anyway, that's what it is. I'm sure you can use the money as good as the state can. Well, listen, you know, I didn't even give a stock report, but the market's been kind of coming up each week and been moving up into the more positive area. And the Dow Jones actually closed at 15,615. And for the last 6 years since the crash at 10907, we're up 10.24% in 6 years, or 1.71%. So I'm not excited about that recovery, but some people are. And if you go back to the turn of the century, back to 12/31/99, the Dow Jones is up a whopping 35.82% over 12 years and 9 months, or an average annual return of 2.81%. The S&P during that same period of time, this is what's really shocking to me, really shocking. The S&P over that 12.75 years, or 12 years, 9 months, is only up 1.56% per year. You know, that's an index for the 80 years previous to the turn of the century, averaged almost 10%. That's pretty scary.
That's 1.55% more than I made on my checking account.
That's about right. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I jokingly said this. I had a person come in the other day, and they have a substantial amount of money. I mean, several hundred thousands of dollars in their savings accounts, earning 0.15%. And I told them, and I was joking, but I was a little bit serious about it. I said, you know, when that bank manager sees you walk in there, they ought to be throwing a party for you. They ought to be, the bells and the whistles ought to be going off. They ought to be, the balloons ought to be going up in the air, and they ought to all be bowing down to you and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you for paying our brick and mortar, because you are definitely helping them. And I am amazed at the amount of people that have money, large amounts of money in money market accounts, absolutely paying nothing, almost paying the bank to keep your money. And it's just the environment that we're in. But, you know, common sense says you can't keep printing money that you don't have. So
that's right. Well, you know, I think the thing that frustrates me and a lot of people out there is how well the banks have come through this financial downturn. You know, they were the ones, nobody forced them to underwrite toxic loans. Nobody forced them to sell it to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac unwittingly, and nobody forced them to hold down troubled homeowners who are underwater and not help them with refinancing. And yet they've come out, their assets are 28% higher, the big six banks, now than they were back in 2008. And that just stinks to me.
Well, you know, when you have 10 banks that are too big to fail, you know, that is a problem. And one of the things that, you know, one of the great things about America is we have a short memory, very short memory. And the Great Depression was not caused necessarily by Wall Street. It was the banks taking over Wall Street. And that's why Roosevelt passed the Glass-Steagall Act, to get the banks the heck out of it so they couldn't own each other, and to keep them kind of separate industries. And when in the 90s, when we did away with the Glass-Steagall Act and we allowed all these big banks now to go in and buy these big companies like Bank America owning Merrill Lynch, now all of a sudden, you know, let's face it, for years and years, the banks are the number one contributors to campaigns. They are the guys paying the big money into the politicians. It is any wonder the politicians bailed out the banks? Of course. That's the guys that put them into office. And I mean, I got to tell you something. If you believe that the Democrats or the Republicans or either one of them is controlled by the bank, it's not one of them. It's both of them. It's both of them. Both political parties are controlled by the big contributors of the banks. And the banks are the ones running this country. And they call it Wall Street, but it's the banks are really controlling Wall Street at this point. And it's, to me, that's kind of scary because they're the guys that control the buck. And it, not that, you know, monopolies are not good, I don't think. I think free enterprise and competition, and if it were up to me, what they should have did is broke all the big, take those 10 big banks, you ought to break them up into 50 entities by state and turn them over to the state and have somebody, investors buy them, take over them and break them into 50 state banks. And I'd be happy as heck. And I think most American citizens would be too, because you'd take that control and all that power away from those 10 big banks. Because if any one of them fails, we don't have enough money in FDIC to cover it. So that's why they say they're too big to fail. They are too big to fail because the government will just have to print more money. God, can you imagine government printing more money than $85 billion a month? Hard to believe. I heard a guy on one of the business networks the other day say that the feds are going to go up to $125 billion a month. Yeah.
Wow. That's going the wrong direction.
I know. Well, listen, we're listening to Investing Simplified. If you got a question next week, give us a call. I'll be at Harry Dent's seminar, and hopefully I'll have some, if I can drag myself in here, I'll try to get in here Saturday morning. I don't know. But thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on Investing Simplified.